chapter 3. I put in the bulletin what was on the schedule for tonight, and a number of people said, "You said you were done with family talk," almost like they were upset. Evidently, the topic is sensitive. Marriage is always a sensitive topic, and family, too. We've done certainly elements of parenting, but just worked out that we're going to sneak one more in, and we're not done with this series by any means. Over the course of years and months to come, we'll address it. But it just worked out that we want to put one more in this evening. We're going to be in the book of Esther. I've said this over the course of the series. Esther may be the greatest book in the Bible on marriage. I guess between Genesis, the book of Proverbs, Esther, Ephesians, because of Ephesians chapter 5, those books would be in the running for greatest material on marriage. And if I were to ever write a book on marriage, I probably would choose the book of Esther. It's just a romantic book. Forget the storyline of how Esther came to power and how they came together. There are so many elements and dynamics that you see between Esther and Ahasuerus. And I know their marriage is unique from the standpoint of he's a king and she's a queen. None of us have that status. He's a pagan man and she's a Jewish woman. And again, we don't have those dynamics. He was an emperor over 127 provinces, so he's got a lot of things to do, a lot of pressure. And we don't have that, obviously, but human nature is what it is. Guys are guys, gals are gals. Typically, you can identify patterns, tendencies. I know people get upset when you generalize. I'm a huge fan of generalizing. You can't generalize. Well, why not? It's my job to deal with people. Guess what? Guys are the same and girls are the same. And couples come into the office sometimes, well, no, we're different. Like, I think it's opposite with us. I really want respect and he wants love. And like, I don't buy it. Within 40 minutes, I can convince you that it's not that way. We try to be different. We all want to be our own person. We all want to be different. No, we're all human beings with very similar tendencies. We are who we are by birth. You can see this in children. We can say more, but we'll leave it there. Esther chapter 3, we're going to be reading just a few verses here. And then we're going to be touching on different parts of the book. A lot of this may sound familiar if you've been with the series, because I've touched on many of these elements. We're just bringing it all together. So let's go ahead and read. We're going to read verse 8 on through verse 15. And just understand at this point that Haman, the Agagite, the bigwig in the Persian Empire, he doesn't like Mordecai. Mordecai is a Hebrew man, and Mordecai wouldn't bow down to Haman. Verse 8, Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people," he's referring to the Jewish people, "there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom. And their laws are diverse from all people, neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore it is not for the king's profit to suffer them. If it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business to bring it into the king's treasuries." This is Hitler hundreds of years earlier. Same idea. We're going to eradicate an entire people. We're going to destroy them. We'll pay people to pull off the killings. Verse 11, "The king said unto Haman, the silver is given to thee, the people also, to do with them as it seemeth good to thee." Well, that was an easy convincing. Verse 12, "The king's scribes called on the 13th day of the first month, and there was written according to all that Haman had commanded unto the king's lieutenants and to the governors that were over every province and to the rulers of every people of every province." Verse 13, this is after it's been sealed with the king's rings, the king's ring. "The letters were sent by post into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, even upon the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar." Verse 14, the copy of the writing for a commandment to be given in every province was published unto all people, that they should be ready against that day. In verse 15, it says the post, or the mailmen, the postmen, the post went out being hastened by the king's commandment, and the decree was given in Shushan the palace. That's kind of the capital of the Persian Empire, where the king was. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city Shushan was perplexed. And that verse stuck out to me some months ago reading through the book of Esther. And you have in verse 15 this canvas. If you could picture a canvas, and on one side of the canvas you've got a scene, and the scene is Haman the king, and Haman, his evil, mischievous counselor, one of his princes, one of his higher-ups. And here they are in the parlor or on the patio of the palace in Shushan, and they're sipping their wine, drinking whatever they're drinking, and then they're just laughing, ha, 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 and life is grand, life is good, and we just signed this decree into law, and Haman's as happy as a clam because he's going to be able to get vengeance on the people he hates, Mordecai and all the Jewish people, and Ahasuerus is happy and so proud of his counselor to help find this rebellious people and eradicate him, so his nation now will be stronger, his administration will be better, and they're just loving life. Can you just picture these guys just living in luxury, loving life? But the canvas has in the background the city. In the foreground is the palace and sipping their wine, but in the background is the city. And in the city, you see mourning, you see grieving, you see a city full of perplexed people. You see a city behind them that it cannot believe this law was passed. It's a tale of two stories. And I saw this some time ago, and I thought to myself, how can the king sit there and ignore the fact that his city, his people behind him or around him are perplexed? He's feasting, they're fasting. He's laughing and living it up, they're mourning and grieving. The city is perplexed because there are many Jewish people in the city. Women and children are going to lose their lives simply because of their DNA. Men are going to lose their lives simply because of their bloodline, because of their heritage. Mothers are going to lose their children. Husbands are going to lose their wives. Neighbors are going to lose their neighbors. People are going to lose their friends. Someone's going to lose their business owner. Someone's going to lose their employee. Everybody is going to be impacted by this terrible law. And furthermore, it's not just this anti-Semitism law. It's this concept of, wait a minute, who decided that they should be all killed? If today it's the Jewish people, who is it tomorrow? The precedent is being introduced that you can lose your life strictly because of what your blood is. Maybe us tomorrow. So the whole city was perplexed. I mean, imagine what America would be if tomorrow the Trump administration passed a law that all Polish people to be put to death, men, women, and children. We would be perplexed. I would be perplexed. I don't have any Polish in me, but I'd be perplexed because I'd be losing so many friends. And I think to myself, if Polish today, why not German tomorrow? This is the picture. Haman and the king loving life, and behind them, beside them, the perplexing city. What a selfish scene. What an inconsiderate leader. And as I look at this picture, I think, what an inconsiderate husband. King Ahasuerus had a massive problem on his hands, and yet he didn't even know it. Isn't it amazing? He just signed his wife's death and doesn't yet know it. I mean, he's got his feet up, his robe is behind him, and he's drinking up, loving life. Oh, Haman, great job, buddy. What a day this is. Our nation will be stronger because of it. Not knowing. He just signed off on the death of his wife, the death of his marriage. Ahasuerus had a problem. His problem was listening to an evil counselor. It was allowing a wicked man to influence his decisions. And while it may look at first glance that he's in his palace minding his own business, The very opposite is taking place. He wasn't minding his own business. The book of Esther is the story of a man who failed to mind his own business, and as a result, desperately needed the intervening of God to save his marriage. This is a story that defines what our marital business is, and it provides the framework of how we as spouses, we as couples, should mind our own business. We'll talk about that when we turn to chapter 4. Chapter 4, we see number 1 in our story, Esther's revelation. Let me read the verses. We'll be in Esther 4, verse 13, and then make some comments. But in this chapter, it's the encounter between Mordecai, who is Esther's adopted father, Mordecai, who gets news of this terrible law, like the city of Shushan, was perplexed. He garnered himself with sackcloth and ashes, and he came to the king's gate and began to pray there in his sackcloth and ashes, which is a no-no in the Persian Empire. And Esther found out about it. She immediately sent clothes and said, Hey, Dad, you can't do that. You'll bring a lot of harm to yourself, and I don't want to see that happen. So put these clothes on, and why in the world are you so upset? Why are you at the king's gate? He says, tell Esther, because this is all through a text message, through chatting, that Esther, don't you know what happened? The king just signed a law that's going to put all the Jewish people to death. She had just heard about that for the first time. Verse 13. Now she was reluctant. Let me just put that in there. Reluctant to talk to the king. That's what Mordecai wanted her to do. And in verse 13, Mordecai commanded to answer Esther. This is what he said. This was the message. Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? What did Esther realize through the course of this conversation with her father? She realized their problem, not just his problem. And by that I mean she realized she now shared the same problem as her husband. It was not just his problem. Even though it was his law, even though it was his counselor, even though it was his job, even though it was his decision, even though it was his ring that signed it, even though it was his money that paid for it, even though it was his problem, it immediately became her problem. Because you're right, Mordecai. I'm Jewish. And just because I'm the king's wife, just because I live in the king's house, it doesn't mean I'll escape this law. You're right, Mordecai. My life is now in jeopardy because of my husband's decision. If there's anything I would like couples and marriages to get, it's this. Your spouse's problems are your problems. There is no way around that. You can try to delegate your spouse's problems to just them. You can try to relegate your spouse's problems to just them. But you cannot do that. It's impossible, because when two become one, what is your problem is my problem. And this story, it illustrates it in such a vivid way, because, yeah, he made a bad law. Oops. You made a bad law that directly impacts your wife. That's right, she's Jewish. She should be killed along with every other Jewish person. Marriage is the union of two individuals, and for that reason, whoever shares the problem, they may initiate it, but they're sharing the problem to make it our problem. Our problem. Well, it's, you know, at work he's just having a hard time, but that's his problem. It's yours now. Well, I leave my problems at work. No, you don't. You may leave the tangible issues there. You may leave your boss there. You may leave your coworker there. But you don't leave your mind there. You don't leave your feelings there. You don't leave your soul there. Whatever problems we experience in life, we take them wherever we go. And so it becomes our spouse's problem. Minding your own business starts with realizing that your spouse's problems are yours, making your spouse's business your business. So, if your spouse has a drinking problem, you have a drinking problem. No, I don't. That's his problem. It was before you got married. Now it's our problem. If your husband has a gambling problem, you have a gambling problem. No, I don't. I don't have a problem with money. He does. There's no he or she in marriage. It's us. It's our. Two shall become one. You can't separate his problems from your life. If your wife has a health problem, it's your problem. If your wife has a fear problem, it's your problem. If your husband has an eating problem, it's your problem. If your wife has a parenting problem, it's your problem. If your spouse has a problem with pornography, it's your problem. If your spouse has a problem with social media, it becomes your problem. If your spouse has a problem with depression, anxiety, spending, extreme views, a problem with family or with friends, those are all your problems. Doesn't marriage sound wonderful? You know, if your spouse has a problem with bitterness, try as you may, that's your problem. Well, I'm praying for him because it's his problem. Pray for us because it's our problem. That's how marriage works. In marriage, there is no thing as your problem. Yeah, I would admit certainly that one may be more responsible for bringing the problem into the marriage, naturally. But I would advise you to temper that sentiment. You know, well, you have the issue with drinking. It's your problem. Careful with that. Because you will find that almost every problem in a marriage, whether it's an individual problem or not, each party, each spouse should take some level of responsibility. And I know that's hard to swallow for a lot of couples, but it's a reality. Let's look at Esther. Who made the law? Ahasuerus or Esther? Ahasuerus, right? His problem, right? Right? Question mark. Why didn't Esther tell her husband she was Jewish? Well, Mordecai told her not to. I don't care why. I don't care why she did if she went to Ahasuerus and said, "You just made a terrible law. You're going to kill all Jews, and I'm a Jew." You think he's going to go, "Oh, yeah, I knew that." He's going to say, "Why didn't you tell me?" To which she'll say, "Because you never asked." Right? Did she not have to take some responsibility in this? Yeah. Well, my husband's drinking has nothing to do with me. Wrong. My husband's gambling has nothing to do with me. Wrong. Two shall be one. I'm very passionate about this topic because I have seen in the little counseling I've done that usually one person in marriage has bigger problems than the other person, and the person with the problems doesn't get the help they need from the person who doesn't have the problems. And at that point, the person who doesn't have the problems has to take some responsibility in not doing more to help the person with the problems, because two shall be one. Your weaknesses, it's my job to help strengthen those. And your strengths are to help with my weaknesses. That's marriage, period. Amen. That's why we're finishing on this topic. All right. Secondly, let's look at Esther's response. What a beautiful response. Verse 15. Then Esther bade them return Mordecai this answer. She says, "Go, gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan, and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. I also and my maidens will fast likewise. And so will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish." What was her response? Oh, how beautiful it is. She prayed and fasted about the problem instead of protesting and fretting about the problem. When you discover your spouse has this addiction, when your spouse has this problem, when your spouse has this tendency, or your spouse made this bad decision, and your spouse is knee-deep in some issue that becomes your issue, the first thing we should do is not slap them across the back of the head and, "What's wrong with you?" The first thing we should do is what Esther did. pray and fast. Pray and fast instead of, how could you? What's wrong with you? Oh no, what's my life going to be like? I wish I never married you. You're so terrible. And on you go with these declarations instead of just doing what Esther did, which is absorbing the problem and taking it immediately to God. I've noticed that few of us with our problems get up in the morning, look ourselves in the mirror and say, you rotten rascal, how could you do this? You're so miserable. You're a piece of garbage. And we don't yell at ourselves for our problems, do we? Typically, we fall on our knees and say, God, help me with my deficiencies. Why we don't do that for our spouse is beyond me, because your problems are my problems. So instead of going to that person and pointing the finger and yelling at them and telling how bad they are, maybe we should treat their problems like we treat our problems, because, by the way, your problems are my problems. And we should fall on our knees and ask God for his intervention. Esther isn't furious toward her husband. She was desperate for God. She didn't ignore her husband's problem. She prayed and fasted over it. She didn't shake her head in disgust. She bowed her head in faith. She didn't pretend it didn't exist. She brought it intensely before God. What is your response to your spouse's problems? And you know exactly what they are, most of you. Have you prayed for that problem, or had you just consistently shook your head in disgust? Is your wife addicted to something, gentlemen? Maybe buying something, it may be attention, it may be clothes, it may be social media, it may be getting the affection from somebody. Is your wife addicted to something? Food, medicine, drugs? Your response should be a desperate prayer life for that wife of yours. And ladies, your husbands probably are addicted to a lot of different things. It could be drinking, it could be smoking, it could be gambling, it could be pornography, it could be buying things, it could be hobbies, it could be playing, it could be hunting, it could be shooting. Whatever it may be, your husband may be addicted to something that you hate it, you loathe it, it impacts you in every way, and you just want to tell him how you really feel about it, and you probably do. I'm telling you, you should get on your knees and beg God for the sake of your husband that God would deliver him. You know why? Because that's your problem. No, it's not. It's his problem. Oh, no, honey, that's your problem. That is your problem, your business. Why are you being so mean to me tonight, Pastor Kay? I'm just passionate about it, really. I am. It's easier to pray and fast when you realize your husband's problem is your problem. And it's a lot easier to protest and fret when you believe it's just his problem or just her problem. Let's look at her restraint. Esther chapter 4, verse 16. She says in verse 16, go gather together all the Jews that are present and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. I also, my maidens, will fast likewise, and so will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law. You can see why I'd like to write a book on this book. What an example for all of us when we learn about our spouse's issues. And that they often surface early in the marriage, but that doesn't mean they don't surface up later in the marriage or new problems exist. But when we learn about some issue in our marriage that impacts us in a great way, is it not our instincts to rush in and address it with haste and often with a lot of passion? And I would think if your life is on the line, as was Esther's, because of her husband's bad decision, that it required some haste. Not something you probably should sit around and debate for a long time. You should probably address that immediately. And yet, when her life was on the line, she doesn't rush in to meet with the king. She says to her father, get the ladies to fast and pray for me 3 days. I and my maidens would do the same. And so for 3 days, she's going to sit on this news. For 3 days, she's going to pray about this news. For 3 days, she's going to think about the potential of her being put to death and her marriage being over and her father being killed and all the city being killed. Jewish people. 3 days. Verse number 1, Esther chapter 5. Now it came to pass on the third day that Esther put on her royal apparel, stood in the inner court of the king's house, over against the king's house. And the king sat upon his royal throne in the royal house, over against the gate of the house. And it was so, when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, that she obtained favor in his sight. And the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. So Esther drew near and touched the top of the scepter. I said earlier in my introduction, which was not in my notes, that human nature is human nature. Women are women, men are men. There is deviation from that a little bit, but we are who we are. It's been like this for 7,000 years. It'll be like this till the end of time. I find it absolutely fascinating that this woman, whose life was in jeopardy, her husband's decision, who sat on the news for 3 days, and when she finally has a chance to confront her husband, she stays standing. Like she sees him for the first time, you dirty rascal, and she stands there till he gets her attention. He sees her, he holds out the golden scepter, and she just gracefully walks in and touches the top of the scepter. Ladies, take no offense, but ruling emotions is hard for anyone, but it is particularly hard for a woman, especially for a woman who's been hurt. And the fact that she didn't pick that scepter up and whack him across the head in itself shows tremendous restraint. This woman did not approach her husband's problem in haste. Let's keep reading. Verse number 3. Then said the king unto her, "What wilt thou, Queen Esther? And what is thy request? It shall be even given thee to the half of the kingdom." And Esther answered, "If it seem good unto the king, let the king and Haman come this day unto the banquet that I have prepared for him." Pause. Wow, this woman's got restraint. She says, "Let's take 3 days, pray about it." Then she sees her husband. She gracefully walks in, touches the scepter. They have this conversation. "What do you want, Esther?" "Save my life, dummy." No. She says, "Oh, husband, dear king, would you come to the banquet that I've prepared for you and Haman?" Woman, your life is on the line. It's time to tell him and to tell him to change that law. No, come to the banquet I've prepared for you. And so she prepares this banquet. She says, "Come," and look what happens in verse 5. The king said, "Cause Haman to make haste, that he may do as Esther hath said." So the king and Haman came to the banquet that Esther had prepared. And the king said unto Esther at the banquet of wine, "What is thy petition? And it shall be granted thee. What is thy request?" And in verse 8, she says this, "If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition and to perform my request, let the king and Haman come to the banquet that I shall prepare for them, and will do tomorrow as the king hath said." I like math. Math is one of the topics that I enjoyed in high school. So I can count. Ready? 3 days plus 1 day is four days. 4 days. She waited before she was going to approach her husband about the problem that he brought into the marriage that would leave her lifeless in just a matter of days. You ready for the miracle of the book of Esther? He had no idea his wife was fuming mad at him. Guys, do you not know when your wife is not happy with you in a matter of seconds, maybe minutes? It's typically very quiet. The countenance is very different. Life around the house is a little different. You know, things may be put down on the counter a little harder, right? We know what it's like when we upset our wives. The king had no idea she was upset with him for 4 days. You know what that is? Governing her emotions, ruling her spirit, restraining herself so that she doesn't, in haste, make a mess of the problem that her husband brought into the marriage, which is now her problem. It's a really, really beautiful story of Esther giving, are you ready for this? God a chance to work. The way the story of Esther is Haman makes this king do this terrible law. Esther finds out about it. She prays and fasts for 3 days, invites the king to a banquet the next day. And by her waiting another day to have this encounter, the king just happens to have a hard time sleeping that night. And while he's trying to sleep, he says, this isn't working. I got to get the Chronicles, a history book, so I'll fall asleep. And he calls in his servants and he says, all right, read the history. I can't fall asleep. Something should make me fall asleep. And he begins to read about Mordecai, who discovered and uncovered and exposed this assassination attempt on King Ahasuerus. And King Ahasuerus just says, what did we do for this man who saved my life? And the servant says, well, nothing's been done for Mordecai. And so Mordecai wakes up, or Ahasuerus wakes up the next day and says, all right, Haman, what should we do to a man I love who saved my life? And of course, the story goes, Haman says, let's honor him by giving him your horse, your robe, your ring. And it's Mordecai. This is the day of the banquet. You say, what's that all about? Well, that's God preparing Ahasuerus to appreciate a Jewish Mordecai, to uncover a wicked servant of his, and more importantly, it was to embolden Esther. Esther was nervous about approaching her husband. She was unsure how he would respond. And so by giving herself a day, God prepared his life, and when Esther heard about Mordecai being promoted publicly, she just gets all excited and says, oh, I got this now. I mean, God has gone before me. God has provided and prepared a conversation, prepared his heart, and we can address this matter. And so we would learn in our marriages also to take our time, to be cautious, to be careful in approaching problems. When we all have problems, we tend to be much more defensive. We're very sensitive about our problems. We're very fragile creatures. We all are very fragile and insecure people. And what we cannot afford to do when exposing or confronting a problem is to rush in like a bull in a china shop, because all that will do probably is shut somebody down, close them off, and keep that problem secure, never to be dealt with. So what? Except it's our problem. Not just his problem. Not just her problem. Our problem. So spend much time with God and spend much time allowing for God to work in your spouse's problem. Number four, let's look at Esther's respect. We see again in verse 5, as we just read, or verse 1 of chapter 5, that on the third day Esther put on her royal apparel and she stood in the inner court of the king's house over against the king's house. And in verse 2, we're reminded once again that when the king saw Esther, the queen, standing in the court, that she obtained favor in his sight. Let me just say very briefly, she stood respectfully instead of marching in and giving him what for. Sure, she obtained favor in his eyes because she was beautiful, because she was his wife. But I can't deny the fact that she must have obtained favor in his eyes because she stood respectfully in front of the king. She looked up to him even when he failed her. She didn't look down at him. She didn't look at him in disdain, disgust, or condescendingly. This is true for men and women when it comes to a desire and need for respect. But I can't help deny the fact that it is absolutely necessary for men. Ladies, your husbands have a great deal of problems they bring to your marriage. And I know you desperately want to address those problems, and address them you should. But you cannot afford to do it without respect. Condescension pushes people away, it isolates people, and especially true for men. Your spouse will not open up to you if you're at all condescending. And if they won't open up to you, you cannot help them. Marital condescension preserves marital problems. By the way, you don't want to preserve marital problems. You want to deal with them. But marital condescension preserves marital problems. And we're all guilty of it. We're all guilty of mocking our spouse at some point for their problems. We're all guilty of rolling the eyes. We're all guilty of shaking the head. We're all guilty of making foolish statements. And these are the worst things we can do for our spouse, for our partner. But we do them, and we should not do them. Let us look at Esther. Let us see her standing at attention, respectfully waiting for the king to summon her in. Well, she's a queen and he's a king. It's different. Men are men, women are women. If you think your husband shouldn't be treated as a king, then don't be surprised when he doesn't treat you as a queen. Men, your wives deserve to be treated as queens. Ladies, your husbands deserve to be treated as kings. I will not. Suit yourself. It's not going to work out for you. See, I represent all the guys that are afraid to tell you these things. Ladies, keep talking to my wife. She writes these sermons, so I beat up on the guys too. Seriously, though, would you not want to help your husband get victory once and for all over some massive problem he has? I'd hope so. You can't do it with disrespect. You can't. Men, this may surprise you because you think testosterone makes us want to fight. But when we are disrespected by women, we just choose the flight. And we will walk away. That's how men are. And we need you to help us, ladies. So please, help us not to fly away. Number five, let's look at her request. Chapter 7. Look at chapter 7. Esther chapter 7. Could you imagine if I did family talk on a Sunday morning? Man, we wouldn't be talking about buildings. We'd be talking about new pastors. Is this being streamed? Verse number 1. So the king and Haman came to banquet with Esther the queen, and the king said again unto Esther on the second day at the banquet of wine, what is thy petition, Queen Esther? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? And it shall be performed even to the half of the kingdom. Then Esther the queen answered and said, if I have found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition, and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. But if we had been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I had held my tongue, although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage. Turn over to chapter 8. Let me read verse 3. And this is a second conversation. And she spake yet again before the king and fell down at his feet and besought him with tears to put away the mischief of Haman the Agagite and his device that he had devised against the Jews. What do we learn here? We learn that Esther asked for a change in her husband instead of demanding a change. There is a substantial difference between the two. Can we all agree that King Ahasuerus didn't know he had a problem in this story? Right? Didn't know? Where do you think the chances are your spouse doesn't know they have a problem? What are the chances your spouse doesn't know how he comes across? What are the chances your wife doesn't realize how deeply entrenched she is into something? Pretty good, actually. And if you demand for your spouse to make the changes you see as necessary, you're going to absolutely shell-shock them. And they probably won't even hear what you're saying. Because demands come across as reprimands. Demands come across as reprimands. Who likes to be reprimanded by their spouse? Reprimand me, Tara. I wake up every day. Give it to me, honey. Give it to me. I can take it. No one does. Especially by your spouse. It's one thing to have your parent reprimand you or your boss reprimand you. But why do we as spouses think we can reprimand each other? That's what a demand is. You fix it. You need to fix it right now. I've had enough of this. You need to change the way you are. You need to change the way you do it. I'm sick of it. Like, those are demands. We all do it. It's a mistake. I mean, how many of us get very far that way? Not many of us, if any of us. If we do get anywhere, it's just out of fear and bullying and intimidation. Asking is so much more effective. It allows for conversation. Esther and Ahasuerus now have this dialogue, this conversation, and they're able to discuss it and get to the bottom of it. Asking for your spouse to make a change, it is contributing to problem solving. And so that's why we should request, we should ask. Remember this rule, write it down if you must, but a demand is a reprimand, while a request is best. Number 6, and finally, I'd like to point out the recommendation that Esther makes in the story. Verse 5 of chapter 8, Esther says to the king, "If it please the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seem right before the king, and I be pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to reverse the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the king, or the Jews, which are in all the king's provinces." Chapter 9. Jump over to chapter 9. Show you one more spot in the book, and we'll be done. "And the king said unto Esther the queen, the Jews have slain and destroyed 500 men in Shushan the palace, and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is thy petition, and it shall be granted to thee? Or what is thy request further, and it shall be done? Then said Esther, if it please the king, let it be granted to the Jews which are in Shushan to do tomorrow also according unto this day's decree, and let Haman's 10 sons be hanged upon the gallows." Yeah, Esther was no weakling. She had a way of finishing this problem, resolving this problem, and her resolution was, "King, husband, can you please have the law written, changed in writing, and send it to all the provinces? O king, O husband, can you give the Jews one more day to have their vengeance on those that would have killed them? O king, can you, let me be specific, can you have the 10 sons of Haman hanged on the gallows?" Now say what you will about her actual recommendation, but the point is she approached the king cautiously, respectfully. She didn't demand, she requested for a change. And then when she and the king had this problem solving, this conversation, she didn't just say, "Well, I don't know how to fix it, just you better fix it because it's your problem." That's not what she did at all. She had a specific set of recommendations to solve the problem. She knew her people. She knew what would appease them. She knew what would help his kingdom. She knew it would solve their marital problem with her life being in jeopardy. And so she made specific recommendations. She offered solutions instead of criticism. I've always concluded it's very easy to point out problems. I do it every Sunday watching football. You would think I am Mr. Lombardi resurrected. I think I know everything about football. It's super easy to point out problems. It's super easy to be a critic. Anybody can do it. What is not so easy is to offer credible solutions to those problems. Just turn on talk radio in Buffalo. Turn on 550 on your AM radio station. Everybody has a criticism. And yet, no one's been able to offer any solutions that are working, right? There may be nothing more frustrating as a person who only knows how to offer criticism without solutions. And in a marriage, if you are the partner who only can criticize without solving the problems, then stop criticizing. Make specific recommendations that will solve the problems, and then here's the key. Allow for conversation regarding your proposal. You know, when you say, "Well, we should do it this way." "Well, let's talk about that." "No, it's got to be this way." "Well, I don't know." And you don't allow for any vetting of that. So this is what I do at the church here. As you can imagine, being in a church, I hear plenty of criticism about things we do. Even in marriage counseling, I hear plenty of criticism about the other individual in the chair. And I welcome constructive criticism. I really do. I don't want this to be in any way me shutting down criticism. I absolutely welcome it. Pastor Phil will attest to that. We will be glad to sit down with you and hear your concerns. But, ... just know that when you bring criticism, I'm going to digest it. I'm going to hear it. I'm going to try to converse with you about maybe why it's something's being done. But here's what I typically always do. I'm going to ask you what your solution is to the problem. And that's not me trying to make you be quiet. That's me sincerely trying to see if you have a proposed solution to the problem, a remedy to the issue you see. Most of the time, people say, "Well, I don't know. I'm just telling you, I don't like how it's being done." All right, well, how would you like me to change it? Well, I don't know, that's why you get paid. All right. I mean, couples do this in the office. Well, he's just that or she's just that. All right, well, what do you want her to do? What do you want her to do about that? You're never home. Well, I don't know, but I just don't like the fact that she... Well, you got to be able to talk about figuring out a problem. You have to recommend something. It was hilarious going into next Sunday night when we're presenting the findings of the vision team. It wasn't too long ago that somebody called me, and they're aware of our conversation, our dialogue regarding the situation. And they called me, and it was a great conversation. And they said, well, Pastor, I'm concerned that if you go this way, here's the problem. Okay. If you go that way, here's the problem with that. I can tell you there's cons over here and cons over that. I said, yeah, I agree. So my question was sincerely, well, how do we address the problem? And the answer we both laughed about. He just started laughing and said, I don't know, that's why you're the pastor. Like, well, thanks. You know. But that's the issue in marriage. If you're only good at pointing out problems without offering specific recommendations, solutions, then that problem that is his problem that's her problem that is our problem will always remain a problem. If you can't work together to solve your spouse's problem, then you'll continue to always have a problem with your spouse, but a problem in your marriage. We think of minding our own business as staying out of somebody's business, right? That phrase we use, mind your own business, stay out of my business. Well, in a marriage, mind your own business means mind my business. Everything about me is your business. And everything about you is my business. There's no such thing as privacy in a marriage. And so what you're doing is hurting me, but no worries. It's our problem. What I'm doing to contribute to your problem, we're going to address. How I can help you with that problem, we're going to address. You're going to tell me what I can do to make this problem go away, because you know what? It's our problem. We're going to fix it. We're going to solve it. We're going to take this problem together and get to the bottom of it. That's the type of problem solving that every marriage needs to have. Let's stand and have a word of prayer.